Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Hi, I'm Deborah Yao, and I'm the editor of AI Business, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Ivana Bartoletti, Global Chief Privacy Officer of Wipro and co-founder of the think tank Women Leading in AI. Welcome, Ivana.
Thank you so much. Really glad to be here with you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at Wipro.
Great. So I'm the Global Chief Privacy Officer of Wipro. That means that I work both internally and with clients on everything that is related to privacy and data protection, which is quite a lot these days. So anything that has to do with the way that we deal with the employees' data, and we have a large employee base, Wipro is large organization with 260,000 employees, and also anything that has to do with the products that we create. We have capabilities in consulting, design, engineering, operations, emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence, generative AI. So what I focus on is very much around privacy by design, fairness in artificial intelligence, ensuring that privacy and data protection, they very much at the core of what we do. So that is my day job. I'm also a visiting fellow in cybersecurity and privacy at Virginia Tech, where my focus again is on cybersecurity and privacy in AI systems. So very much a sort of career in privacy and data protection.
That's wonderful. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the EU AI Act, which was just approved, and it's probably the most sweeping AI regulation of its kind in the world for now. So what do you think of its stipulations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question because I think AI is already regulated, even without the European AI Act. And it's really interesting because actually the first of its kind in terms of regulation in employment sector comes from the US. And for example, from New York, the FTC in the US has been very strong in the financial arena to say, hey, you have to be fair. We can't have algorithms that discriminate against people. To an extent, AI has been regulated, privacy legislation, data protection, non-discrimination law, human rights, consumer law, all of these, they already apply to artificial intelligence. What the European AI Act does, it focuses on the product. So it identifies products that are high risk. And by high risk, it means that they are a threat to the fundamental values binding Europe together, or they are part of products that are already high risk. So for example, aviation or machinery that is used in healthcare. And all of these systems that are higher risk, they have to make sure that they undergo some due diligence. And also there are systems that are just not allowed, they're banned in the EU. So the approach of the European Union here is very much on product and is very much aimed at a little bit like the GDPR. So creating a shared definitions across the EU, a shared market across the EU, in trying to combine, I would say, the values of the European Union with innovation. But what is really interesting, Deborah, is what is happening with the US at the moment. The Trade and Technology Council, I think, is the most interesting development in recent times. And what I find really interesting is the taxonomy that the council has just published. And is the taxonomy around AI. So what does AI means? What does machine learning means? And words are very important. So the fact that the EU and the US have agreed on a taxonomy, which means they've agreed on the basic vocabulary that defines the terms, and that is really important. So although AI has been regulated for a while already, because it's part of the systems do not exist in isolation, European AI Act focuses on product, but there is also an alignment with not just, you know, there's also a lot of difference, but there's also an alignment between the US and the EU on defining responsible, trustworthy artificial intelligence. So this is the sort of development, and I think the European AI Act is part of the sort of wider development and relationship between the US and the EU on AI.
I guess a natural question there would be, why is having the same taxonomy important and key here?
Well, it's very important because there's a lot of confusion on what AI is or what generative AI is. And definitions are important because having the same definition means that we can have a common ground and acting together. And I think what we have seen in recent times is, especially coming from the US and then from President Biden, is a call for like-minded countries and nations to align behind a benevolent, responsible, and trustworthy use of artificial intelligence. And this is the direction of travel that I think we are seeing, and its expression is in the Trade and Technology Council. And I think that is it's really important. It has very serious geopolitical also reasons and why this is happening. But I think it's crucial that sort of we bear that in mind, you know, that creating the vocabulary means creating the basis for collaboration and the basis that we can build on.
What do you think about the EU AI Act's approach to looking at the product and also assessing via the different risk levels?
This is a really interesting question because a risk-based approach is pragmatic, because it means that you don't tackle all AI together. You just say, okay, some products, they have a bigger impact on, for example, our dignity or our potentially our civil liberties, or, for example, an algorithm that discriminates you, that can potentially discriminate you. For example, deciding whether you can have access to a job or not, or what level of medicine is going to go into your body. I mean, those things, they carry more weight to an extent, right? So the risk-based approach makes sense pragmatically. However, I think that this comes with the risk itself, because some areas like privacy that are more related to human rights, sometimes I don't feel that they completely fit the risk paradigm, the risk sort of lenses. You know, there's something more to that. Because the language of risk, to an extent, means that you accept the product, you accept the AI, and the only thing you do is to tinker in the corners, right? So you just basically say, well, I'll mitigate it. But you don't question whether you should have the product in the first place. It comes with risk in the sense that I understand it and I embrace it in a way that I think it's pragmatic, and I think it brings together innovation and mitigate some of the sort of the most damaging things that could happen. But it's also quite limiting because that doesn't really challenge the product in itself, the artifact in itself. So especially in an area like artificial intelligence, it could be a little bit limiting.
Do you have any thoughts on the approaches of other countries like the US and the UK and elsewhere?
I think we are seeing an alignment in many ways, in the sense that every single country is doing something about it, right? Some of the strictest legislation around algorithms actually come from China. Very interesting to read, you know, into, of course, it's a different approach. LLMs and this entire area around generative AI is more challenging. It's challenging for China, obviously, because they worry about this information, they worry about it's very strong. So obviously the controls that China's put in place are strong around algorithms, where the data come from, for example, the targeting of individuals in online, all of this, you know. So so I have to say that there is regulation in China. India is not only the cabinet in India has approved the privacy bill just a few days ago, but it's also said very clearly that there will be regulation to harness the value of generative AI, but do so in a responsible manner. And then you have Europe, and then you have the UK, which has gone for a sort of third way since Brexit. Basically saying we don't want to regulate, but we will empower existing regulators to adapt the current systems to the new challenges that AI is bringing. And then you have the US, where legislation is not, I mean, legislation, the approach is less product-based, like in the EU. So, for example, the European AI Act applies to products regardless of the sector. So the Act applies to a high-risk product because it's high-risk, not because it's in healthcare or because it's... whereas the US approach is a bit more sectorial. So you have seen in the financial services, in housing, in employment, so different sectors approaching artificial intelligence in different ways. And I think it's really interesting to see the different approaches across countries. So we are aligned on, I think, across the globe on the understanding that we need to regulate. Generative AI also, I think, has brought a new dimension to this, because the new dimension is around the risk that generative AI can have on our own democratic viability because of this potential spread of AI-generated fake news, how easy it is to produce them, the erosion of the public trust, and of course, with the current geopolitical situation and the invasion of Ukraine and all of that, then the risk of political turmoil is obviously adding a lot of pressure on countries to assess these risks around generative AI. So we're aligned on recognizing the issues. We have different approaches. Also, because AI is more and more part of the tech sort of diplomacy, part of geopolitical dynamics, so there are also alignments that have been created between countries, territories, and jurisdictions, and more the language of technology is part of something that is much bigger than that. So it's really a fascinating time to see how this sort of regulation around artificial intelligence will develop, and whether we will be able to do something which is a little bit more international, although the sort of the timings is not the easiest one at the moment.
So do you really need special rules for generative AI, or can it be regulated under more general AI rules?
I think there are specific considerations in generative AI, and they are related to several things. For example, you really need to reinforce the fact that AI generated images or news, they have to be labeled as such. I think it's really important also to realize that there are issues around where the data is coming from. The fact that this data may be the data that is scraped from the web, from all sources, it may be replicating stereotypes that are present in societies. And this is a really fascinating situation because, for example, I do love the idea of having human knowledge at your disposal. I use cohesive AI, I use different tools that allow me, for example, to help me and assist me, which is what these tools should do. You know, they should assist, not replace. They should, they should enhance your productivity, not replace you, because they can't do the job that you do. But I also feel, so I find it great to have this access to knowledge, but I also find it scary because I feel what is happening, for example, to language, or what is happening to the nuances of language. And if this data is trained on the large data sets that are available in the world, then the language is definitely a biased language, because most of language, especially in countries where you have, like the one I come from, Italy originally, and they have a more sort of patriarchal background, then language inevitably will replicate stereotypes. And I sometimes worry about these tools replicating gender stereotypes, and I think we have to be very cautious about it. This is why it's really important to have safeguards in place, and also to educate people, because I would never want to see generative AI being used to replace people. Never. Because generative AI is not there to replace, it's there to augment. I mean, I always do this. I mean, this is the approach that I've taken with Wipro. You know, it's the lens here is productivity. We can become more productive, which is important because it means that I can spend my time doing something more interesting. And also it means that I can have less repetitive stuff. And this works really well. But at the same time, the education is that you can't take this product for granted. I mean, the text that comes up from a blog generator you can't just take it and copy it because you can find an idea, but you really have to check the language. You've got to put yourself into it. And this is where I think these are the specificities around generative AI that we need to bear in mind.
So recently, around 150 executives from Europe came out and signed an open letter saying that the EU AI Act would restrict them from developing AI more robustly. And as such, the EU stands to lag behind other countries in this innovation. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a complex issue because, first of all, I honestly do not believe that the European AI Act can hinder innovation. I never believed that there is either innovation or the preservation and protection and even enhancement of human dignity and the protection of human beings. I mean, I cannot see this. And if there is a dichotomy between these two things, that is not innovation in my view. We have to have the courage to bring the two together. And this is important because, and it's also in financial and economic terms, this is important because the more people benefit, the more people can trust these products, can use these products. And by using these products, they generate data, and with generation of data, then this data can be trained into the system. So even from a financial perspective, to me, it makes sense to bring together innovation and the safeguarding of human dignity, privacy, and all of that. So that is one point. The other point is that this is what Europe does. And it's called the Brussels effect. You know, it's the idea that a confederation, to an extent, a group of 27 countries that negotiate and legislate in a democratic way, that's what they do. They have what is called the Brussels effect, which is the idea that you can set some requirements and have the ambition to act as a global regulator. So Europe is called sort of the Europe Agenda 2030 is about technological sovereignty, which they can, to an extent, it can be argued that the way to achieve it is through this Brussels effect, because Europe at this stage doesn't have Google and doesn't have Alibaba. It doesn't have the big companies that America has, and it doesn't have the big companies that China has. So obviously, this is what Europe does. I would encourage business leaders to really embrace the opportunity to bring together innovation and the safeguarding of rights. Of course, the AI Act is not perfect. Of course, it requires a lot to happen at national level. We haven't seen the standards yet that have been developed at the moment. And of course, companies are intervening now because now the Act is going to the tripartite dialogue. That means that there is a little space for lobbying.
So talking about the different AI regulation efforts in different countries, how can companies navigate this landscape? Surely some of those regulations could conflict.
Oh, for sure. And to an extent, it's a little bit like what happened with the GDPR. No, that at the beginning, the GDPR was the flagship regulation, so there was Europe. Now, arguably, you know, there are so many legislation around the world around privacy. Even in the US, you have different state legislations. So it's that's a challenge for sort of regulatory compliance. I think, first of all, is I always say we need to focus on what's in common. So what's in common is fairness. So the idea that algorithms, AI should not discriminate, not just for ethical issues, but also to have a correct output. Okay, so having a correct. So that is across every single legislation that I've seen or proposal for legislation. Then transparency, meaningful transparency. So whether it's about the data provenance, it's a requirement that is discussed everywhere. Interpretability, that does not mean that you have to show a code. You know, it wouldn't be useful to a normal person. And also it would be very difficult for companies, especially where the code is their IP. It's them, you know, it's what. So, but sort of transparency and also privacy. And I wouldn't underestimate privacy because privacy is already regulated. There are already legislations. So I always say to companies with mine, I would say, we've got to get it right from a privacy standpoint, because half of the work would be done, in the sense that if we do privacy by design in AI, that means that we solve the problem of provenance or transparency, we solve the problem of fairness, we solve the problem of data subject rights and information rights, which are things that are present in legislation all around the world. I mean, from California to the GDPR to the LGBT in Brazil and India, people have access, a right to access their data. Now, how you do that in AI, it's not easy, because you may have to go and create a machine that unlearn rather than learn, because you have to, people still have a right to be forgotten. No, so I think it's really important to focus on what's in common and start from there. What's in common is already a lot. And then there are really interesting standards that the companies can work on and can really rely on, which is, for example, from a security standpoint, NIST, and then you have the IEEE, and then you have, I mean, all this, the OECD guidelines on responsible AI, relying on an international framework is very important, because it means that you can have a reference point which is international recognized. But my advice is not to postpone any of this, because if you want your product to be, and your innovation to be future-proof, you need to make sure that you are coding the regulatory requirements and in from the onset.
So there's talk about establishing a global AI watchdog, similar to the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, given concerns by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman about the potential existential threat of AI. So what are your thoughts on establishing this global AI watchdog along those lines?
I think it would be too easy and wrong to say we just want something like the European Atomic Agency, because the European Atomic Agency was done in a specific time with specific concerns. And although the parallel with nuclear is very useful to us, and in my book, An Artificial Revolution, Power Politics and AI, I made that parallel in 2018. So even before Google, AI Godfather made it. But what I'm saying is the parallel with nuclear is very important, in the sense that academically, but from an academic standpoint, academically, you could say that nuclear has got great potential and great risks. And this is the same to AI. So what did we do with nuclear? With nuclear energy, we created international avenues that worked. Didn't really work. If you think about the sort of the EU-Iran nuclear deal, it took a long, long time. But the issue is that we recognize globally that we need to regulate this sector. The problem is that when it comes to AI, there is something different. And what's different is that AI evolves and the capabilities become stronger and bigger. So with nuclear, we know what the risks are. With AI, we do, but to an extent, we don't. When I say we need a global observatory or a global body to oversee all of this, I don't mean it in the sense that I want to replicate what the European Atomic Agency, the Atomic Agency does, because that is a different time, a different political global situation. And also it can't really deal with the evolving capabilities of artificial intelligence. And I think that behind some of the calls, an agency like that, there is, yes, the recognition of the potential harms of AI, which is genuine and is important to recognize that. To an extent, there's also a potential of distracting us from the harms of AI that we know of already, like privacy, disinformation, misinformation, security, the exploitation of the most vulnerable, all of this that could happen already with artificial intelligence. So to an extent, by talking about dramatic risks and even the risk of extinction of the whole of humanity, I feel that it's very much a distraction from avoiding to sit down around the table and deal with the nitty-gritty of the real harms that we know of, that we've already seen in action and that we need to not just to mitigate, but we need to eliminate. Yes, I think these calls are important. I would like these calls to come not because AI is leading us to the destruction and extinction of humanity, and therefore we need an international body to do this. I would like to see these calls coming from the fact that and we need a global place, an avenue where we can put together, we can look at, you know, the different, what different countries are doing, where there could be some investigative powers, for example, publishing indexes of what is happening in different countries, a little bit like what Transparency International does to an extent. You know, when you have this report coming from countries where you have this, where you can go and look and what is the level of protection of the individuals? What is the level of protection of the environment? Because artificial intelligence needs to be sustainable. All of this. So that's how I think an international body, that's what an international body should do. And really bring together the best minds at global level. But what it cannot do is it cannot replace the laws that we need to enact. And this is why I get a little bit suspicious when I hear calls for this body to be set up as a way to avoid doing what needs to be done right now. Because these bodies, you know, they may take 5-10 years before they go into action.
Well, two questions immediately arise in my mind based on what you just said. And one is, do you have any thoughts of how we deal with this evolving AI threat? Because like you said, you know, with nuclear, the threats are known and you don't really, it doesn't change, but AI gets stronger and smarter. Do you think that the solution is regulation for this evolving strength of AI, or do you think the solution is engineering?
So I think there's not one solution, Deborah. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that need to happen together. So there are different things. So there is, of course, regulation that is very important. But regulation is no panacea, right? So, and also because most of AI is already regulated. So what is important to say is that things like before a product hits the market, the product has to undertake due diligence. That is very, you know, that is very important. And it needs to be done. Businesses being accountable for what they're doing. I mean, there is also governance and that is business responsibility. The idea that businesses are held accountable for the product they put in the market, the systems that they use, the due diligence that they apply. Then there is the responsibility of governments of enforcing legislation. There is the responsibility of countries to also enhance the digital literacy of individuals, because that is, you know, is a must to enhance the digital literacy, to ensure that we have more diverse workforce into these sectors. We still have a male-dominated sector. This is not going to help democratizing and creating better AI if we still have a very homogeneous workforce, especially in the West. So it's multi-layered. And I obviously do believe that we need sort of an international approach, but we also need, especially right now, I think we also need a alliance to an extent and getting together behind some principles around good AI with countries that are they're aligned behind democratic values. This is for different reasons. This is for economic reasons, obviously, because, you know, it's really about alliances and but it's also because more and more, as we said earlier, sort of technologies has gone way beyond tech. I mean, AI goes way beyond technology. It's really into the realm of the economy, of international relationships, of technology diplomacy and all of that. So I think it's very much multi-layered. But I do think we are in a crucial moment in the relationship between humanity and technology right now. We've got to get it right. I was a little bit if I can say something, I was a little bit surprised yesterday when I saw this, it was Friday, I think, when I saw this conference in Geneva on the state of AI. And it was actually a United Nations conference at the with the ITU. And they had taken robots to speak. And they were asked questions by the journalist. And I thought there was a good and clever idea to do that. But I also was looking at these robots and I was thinking, why do these robots look so human? And of course, the female looking robots were looking very slim, very stereotypical, very. And I'm thinking, is this the future that we want? I mean, this is when I say this is a crucial relationship between humanity and technology. This is what I mean, you know, in terms of defining the big questions, you know, do we want these robots to be, do we need to make it so human looking? Do they reiterate the stereotypes and the prejudice that we have in society? Do we really need to, I mean, how do we create AI that is sustainable and doesn't damage the environment? How do we safeguard our democratic viability? I mean, those are the big questions right now. And I think that if we get it right, then we will be able to deal with sort of emerging capabilities of artificial intelligence. And I think it's going to be a challenge moving forward, but an interesting one.
So one quick question, and then I want to talk about your think tank, or as you call it, action tank, Women Leading in AI. So do you think AI poses an existential threat? Do you have a position on that?
No, I don't think that it necessarily does. I mean, I think AI poses risks that are not new in the sense that they've been highlighted for a long time. Joy Bullen-Winnie highlighted the risk of facial recognition failing to recognize women of color a while back, years ago. Sophia Nubble talked about AI risks and the automation of inequality and for a very long time has been talking about this. Meredith Whitaker and a lot, especially women, American women, a lot of women in the US, they've been leading on this for a very long time. And they've also, some of them have also lost their jobs because of this. So these risks are not new. We've known them. And we also know some of the answers. So I'm not concerned about AI bringing catastrophic risks. I'm concerned about humans not accelerating regulation and governance so that we can make the most of AI. That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, talk to me about Women Leading in AI. So you're one of the co-founders. When you started this organization, what was your goal in doing so? And what are you guys doing?
So Women Leading in AI was born because it was a funny story, because actually it was International Women's Day was approaching. And we were having a think about, with some colleagues and academics, business women, we were having a conversation about what happens when with artificial intelligence. And we were saying there was a time where stories were starting to emerge. So for example, less credit being given to women because women traditionally earn less than men, and other stories like that, like Compass, the algorithm in the US, which was the ReProbica story that brought to public attention how this algorithm was giving Black people a higher degree of recidivism, regardless of what crime they had committed. So these stories, they started to come out, and we were thinking, wow, you know, we all consider ourselves feminists in that group, and we were thinking, we've been like fighting so much for all this, and then now we've got AI, and all these things are going to come, and then, you know, these things are going to come back. And then we were thinking also, and that was very much also a personal feeling that I had, I was feeling that a lot of these tools that were coming up in AI, I wasn't really benefiting in the sense that I was, instead of doing three things at the same time, as often women do, I was doing 10 things at the same time. With IT, with the IoT, with AI, I had to do even more than before, like, you know, like working was ordering things on Amazon or, you know, doing, because it was technologically possible. But instead of freeing up my time, I was actually having to do more. And when I started to share these feelings with other women, they felt the same. And so we started to say, well, actually, one of the reasons why this is happening is because we are not in power. We're not deciding which tools we're going to produce. We're not looking at the data sets, because if we were looking at the data sets, we would probably identify a problem and say, hey, if you use these parameters, if you use this data, the result is going to be biased. We said we need more women. We need more women in AI policy. We need more women running companies and product development. We need more women coding. So it's not just more women in tech. We need more women where the decisions are taken around the policies surrounding AI. So that is simply how everything came out. And I wrote an article in The Guardian in England. And I just convened. I said, let's meet up at the London School of Economics. We got a room and 160 women showed up. And that's how we started. And then and it's been a fantastic experience so far. Now, Women Leading in AI has partnered with Equality Now, which is a big equality-based organization. And they working very closely to the UN, with the UN. And Equality Now and Women Leading AI have founded a campaign called Alliance for Universal Digital Rights, where we have put together some proposals for what human rights mean in the digital age. And we are working with the UN Tech Envoy on the Digital Compact, which is the new tool that the UN will issue, most likely in 2024, what human rights mean in the digital age, which is will go together with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Well, that's a really great point, because in the design of AI products and systems and services, it helps to have a diverse point of view. So you ensure that the right things are developed for the right audience in the right way. And you take out not just bias, but just the inconvenience of not knowing the habits of certain groups of people, certain genders, etc. So what's next for Women Leading in AI? What have you been up to and what's next?
So what we've been up to, like really working with Equality Now and setting up this campaign, which has been really, really nice, because we brought together these two organizations. So Women Leading AI, which very much, you know, women coming from business, women coming from academia, women coming from all sort of walks of life. And then Equality Now, which is an organization that really works to change society through the law, right? So they are mostly human rights lawyers. They work at the heart of the UN and the heart of governments. So we brought together these two organizations and to really shape and help shape the digital compact. So for example, we will be at the Internet Governance Forum and to work with what, you know, what the digital compact means for women, how we can create a tool and we can advocate for a tool that can be useful and can be maybe not enforceable because it can be used and leveraged by courts at national level in cases that, for example, require redress for people when they've been, for example, subject to AI-generated harm. So that is, so this is the focus at the moment, and which is, and then obviously we do a lot of convening, supporting women, mentoring, helping women to find the next role, helping women to transition from, for example, going from a maternity leave to wanting to learn how to code. So there's a lot of that as well, a lot of sharing of knowledge. It's a safe space. And then, of course, we've done a lot of work on the European AI Act. I've just written a report for the Council of Europe on which is a large organization. It's not just Europe, also includes members from all over the world. And just written a report for the Council of Europe on artificial intelligence and gender, so potential risks and opportunities. So it's the work that we do is very much around supporting women and campaigning for more women in policy.
Wonderful. We'll leave it there. This was a very fascinating and interesting conversation. Thank you, Ivana, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.